This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. Shelters provide a vital lifeline and a safe space for survivors of domestic violence or any form of gender-based violence, especially when they have, when they don't know where or who to turn to. And so with the recently launched pilot program by the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development together with the Federal Territory's Islamic Religious Department, 14 mosques across the capital city will be used as transit centres for domestic violence survivors. And so today I want to discuss why this move is important and also touch on what it takes to actually run a domestic violence shelter. So I am joined by Sumitra Viswanathan, the Executive Director of the Women's Aid Organisation. And, you know, with the recently announced third nationwide MCO, you know, I'd like to also touch on the impact that this might have on gender-based violence later on. But thank you so much for joining me today, Sumitra.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having us on.
So let's get into it, right? What are your thoughts on this pilot program that the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development has launched? I understand that WAO has released a statement to welcome this move. Could you elaborate more on that?
Yeah, so absolutely. So we are delighted, actually. So WAO, since 1982, we are in the business of providing safe spaces for women to survive the effects of domestic violence. And we've been running our shelter since then. So we have actually been advocating really strongly for all sectors of community to step forward, to understand that the prevalence of domestic violence and other forms of gender-based violence against women, to recognize that as various sectors of the community have the responsibility to ensure that we are all capacitated and able to respond and provide the support that is needed. One very core part of recognizing, responding and referring domestic violence survivors is, you know, religious communities. So it can be regardless of the religion or the denomination, etc. That is a very key component of the response to domestic violence. Indeed, in 2014, when USM's Kanita actually did a survey on the prevalence of domestic violence, what they found is, and I can't remember exactly what the percentage is, but many survivors of domestic violence reach out to religious leaders for support. And so having that awareness, not just the awareness amongst religious leaders of domestic violence and what needs to be done to ensure women have access to justice and support, but also capacitating themselves to be able to respond appropriately. So we are absolutely delighted, and we'd like to see this being replicated more with more than 14 mosques moving forward, and also in other religious organizations and religious movements. We need to see this happening.
You know, you mentioned that a lot of women turn to religious leaders. What is the reason behind that? Is it because of that sense of familiarity that they know that person?
Yeah, so I'm not sure it's necessarily because they have a pre-existing connection with that particular religious leader. But, you know, in times of strife, in times of need, when you're at your lowest, you really do turn to what your cultural upbringing and cultural norms tell you as signal to you as being the source of support. So that is just one important source of support that women turn to. Women also turn to police. Women also turn to, you know, women's NGOs like WAO. But it's what we find so positive about this is that the religious community and indeed mosques are recognizing that they have a key role in providing support and, you know, potentially also assisting in the eradication of violence against women and kids in Malaysia. So recognizing that they have an important role, capacitating themselves to provide that response and being clear about it as well is such a positive development. We are so happy to see this happen.
But, you know, are there concerns over anonymity or safety because these locations are sort of known to the community?
Yeah. So it's about balancing. Okay. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we need to know that such a service is indeed available. And so there needs to be public awareness mm-hmm. about the fact that these 14 mosques are indeed providing this kind of service. On the other hand, you need to have that environmental safety and security for the women and the kids who are going to avail themselves of this service, right? So in 2015, WAO released standards, national standards on domestic violence shelters, which was also adopted by the government. The mm-hmm. Ministry of Women at that time also reviewed it and put their stamp of approval on it. So on the basis of these standards, WAO has been advocating with various segments of society, community, and government. There are some very key standards in there, including standards on how to preserve and protect the safety and security of women physically within that physical environment of the shelter. So we welcome indeed this development, but at the same time, yes, thank you for raising that issue. So we would call upon these 14 participating mosques to also refer to the WAO shelter standards. The standards are available in Bahasa and English. It's an important guidance document. It has the seal of KPWKM, the Ministry of Women, on it. So it is indeed recognized as national shelter standards. So do refer to it, do be guided by it, and it provides indeed the standards and the best practices that should be in place.
Mm-hmm. And just very briefly, you know, for the benefit of the listeners, right? I mean, what are sort of the basic criteria that a shelter needs to fulfill to play that role? Because it's not just about, you know, providing a roof over someone's head, right?
Absolutely, spot on. What we always say is it is more than a pillow for your head and a roof over your head. It's also about the sort of the philosophy behind providing that shelter. It's also about the services mm-hmm. that come within that shelter. And it's also about knowing what kind of support is required post-shelter. So the philosophy really is about ensuring that whatever response is provided is survivor-centered. What does that mean? That means you need to understand what the woman needs. You need to provide her information, number one, and then to ensure that she's able to take informed decisions about what she wants to do next. And then recognizing, of course, again, bringing attention to the fact that everything that you do for the survivor has to be survivor focused, has to include her and her kids in whatever decision making. It's also about being guided by the law. The law, the Domestic Violence Act, is very clear mm-hmm. on what is criminal, that domestic violence is a crime. And something that I want to make very clear is we don't negotiate with criminals, right? We don't negotiate with criminals. So we shouldn't be ever promote a situation where there is, in the time of crisis, there is an attempt to reconcile the survivor with the perpetrator. A crime has been committed. That needs to be recognized. As a result of that crime, harm has been sustained by the survivor. The survivor needs to have support and shelter from that harm being repeated. That's extremely important. The other thing is the sort of support services that also need to be provided in that shelter environment. And that includes some key things like ensuring continued access to education for the kids, if there are kids, ensure medical attention, ensure counseling and psychosocial services are also available for the survivor. That's super important, and access to justice. So things like making a police report, if that is indeed what she would like to do, ensuring that her and her kids are able to receive that interim protection order, that the police are actually doing the appropriate follow-up for the case and so forth. So all of that needs also to happen. And then post-shelter. So what happens post-crisis? There needs to be ongoing support for the survivor and her children. Because stepping outside of the shelter and overcoming that initial crisis doesn't mean the end of the need. The need continues, the reintegration, the support for independent living, and to be able to stand on her feet again. So that is the continuum of service that needs to be provided. And then one more thing which I forgot to mention also is facilitating that access. So yes, public awareness that the service indeed is being provided by that particular mosque, but access usually comes via a hotline or referrals. So those referral pathways, including with police stations and also hospitals, etc., need to be established. And also, as far as possible, please enable that hotline so that it is available. Women know who to call when they can call in order to receive access to that safe shelter. Mm. So that's a lot. But, you know, when you take this on, you have to do it right.
I mean, it's a lot, but it just goes to show how much, you know, work it takes to ensure the safety of these women, these children, right? Because it's not just, you know, it goes back to what we were saying at the start. It's not just about providing a roof over their head. You know, it needs to be holistic. And from what I hear from you, you know, it really takes a lot of commitment. It takes a lot of resources because you can't just jump in and say, okay, I've provided you with a safe space, but the rest is up to you, you know, because they need that help.
Yeah. And also, you know, that whole issue of victim blaming as well. So again, it comes back to the philosophy around providing the support. So we always, along the way, along the survivor's journey, we always have to be really, really mindful of our own biases and our own perceptions of gender roles and etc. And it's extremely important that we step away from victim blaming because there is nothing worse for a survivor than to be faced with victim blaming because she's already in such a confused state of you know trauma, etc. So when you also throw in victim blaming into that mix, it's hugely devastating. So according to what we have read, the Jawi officers that will be providing the psychosocial support, etc., have been trained and sensitized to domestic violence response. But again, you know, WAO stands ready to help provide support, to help with learning, and also to help with, assisting the mosque and the service provider to review the service that is being provided and to provide feedback on how it can better improve. We stand ready to assist, to make this work, because potentially, you know, it is so powerful because if this can be upskilled throughout the nation, the impact is going to be tremendous.
All right. On that note, we'll go for a quick break now. I'm speaking to Sumitra Viswanathan, the executive director of the Women's Aid Organization. And we're talking about a recently launched pilot program by the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development, which will see 14 mosques across KL being used as transit centers for domestic violence survivors. So we're talking about why that's significant, as well as the role that shelters play for survivors of domestic violence. So we'll continue our conversation after a few messages. Keep it here on Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. Joining me on Zoom today is Sumitra Viswanathan, the Executive Director of the Women's Aid Organization, and we're talking about a pilot program by the federal government that will involve 14 mosques across KL being used as transit centres. We're also talking about what it takes to run a shelter for survivors of gender-based violence against women, especially domestic violence. And now, Sumitra, the WAO has been running a shelter since 1982. Like you mentioned, it is also the largest shelter for domestic violence survivors in Malaysia. Could you tell me more about the WAO Refuge? You know, what's the intake process like? And who can reach out to you for shelter?
Okay, so our shelter is licensed by JKM to house actually no more than 12 women and their families and their kids at any one time. So we're very, very mindful about things like space considerations, etc. So I want to emphasize that, yes, WAO has a shelter. We've been in the business of providing shelter for women survivors for many years. Yes, we are the experts, but we are just one NGO, right? Mm. So it's important to recognize that. So what happens is the survivor is either referred to us by a service provider or a bystander, etc., or the woman self-refers. And the contact with WAO first is via our hotline.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is we do an assessment. We try to do it face-to-face. If there are restrictions like MCO restrictions, etc., we do it over the phone. And we make that assessment as to whether WAO crisis shelter is the most appropriate space for her. And then she is admitted into the shelter with her kids. So at this time, because we are in the pandemic period, before she actually enters the shelter, we have a transitional space where she will stay with her kids. Because we need to do the COVID test first and check her health status, etc. And then she is admitted into the shelter. So throughout this whole process, case management will already begin. And case management is done by our social workers. And our social workers take a holistic view mm-hmm. of the woman and the kids and their needs. And so they will assess, everything is survivor-focused, but they will assess her needs from the perspective of health, psychosocial wellness, justice, access to justice, the police report, and so on and so forth. So the social work will continue. And then at some point, our programs will also kick in. And the programs really are very much focused on two things, her emotional resilience and further forward into the future, her economic resilience. Because domestic violence causes so much damage to the woman, not just from the perspective of her emotional wellness, but also her ability to function in the economic sphere. Often women come to us with debt because of financial violence and so forth. So our programs also help her get over that. And then post-shelter, we continue the support. And the support, again, continues to be on her emotional and economic resilience. And if she has kids, we focus a lot on the kids' psychosocial wellness and educational attainment. So it's very comprehensive. It's extremely resource intensive. And WAO's budget as a whole to run our WAO services is in the region of 2 million ringgit a year.
Wow.
So it is because, you know, as I mentioned before, if we want to do it and we want to do it in an impactful way,
mm-hmm.
we have to do it well and comprehensively. And that's how much it costs to run such a program.
Mm. So. You know, you mentioned post-shelter follow-up multiple times. I mean, how long does that last? You know, and how do you make that decision on, you know, how often to follow up or how long to follow up for?
Yeah. So again, it's very much survivor-driven.
Mm.
It's really the assessment of the woman herself that, you know what, I don't need WAO anymore. I'm good on my own. But even once she reaches that stage, we still do check in from time to time to make sure that everything's okay and so forth. Something that we all have to be really mindful about is, you know, repeating the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So if the pattern is repeated and to make sure that she is strong in her core, her kids are strong in their core, the relationship between the mother and the child is being maintained, is healthy and so forth. And it's that regular check-ins. It's hard to say for sure when it ends. It really is survivor-driven. It is driven by what she feels she needs. And we're there to provide that support.
Hmm. Have you ever encountered situations where perhaps there are women who feel reluctant to come into a shelter?
Yes. So again, because it is a shelter, it is shared living spaces and so forth. So there are survivors who feel some discomfort at that. There are also survivors who feel that potentially they could be stigmatized. Mm. But mainly the fear is about how safe is it really? That again is something that we're extremely mindful about. And so that's why it's part of the service that we provide. We also engage private security company to ensure, you know, the physical safety. We have a direct line to our local police station. And they know that, you know, when we call, it's because it's something serious and they need to come quick. We have an excellent relationship with our local police station. So it's a combination of fear of stigmatization, maybe discomfort with, you know, shared living space, and also concerns about security is really, you know, quite paramount for a lot of women.
Mm. I can imagine there must be so much training that goes into, you know, everyone who works at a shelter like at WAO.
Yes, so much training. We do a lot of training. Training and follow-up training. And, you know, that issue of stigmatization, that's why it's so powerful for the mosque to be the place of shelter for mm-hmm. the woman survivor. It's so powerful because it sends out a message to our entire society that violence against women is wrong. We will not tolerate it. And to express our intolerance towards this, we are opening our space to make sure that she gets the safety and support that she needs. That is such a powerful message to send out there, and we are so happy to hear of it.
Mm, and it sends the message that there are people out there who are ready to help if you need it, right? There are people who are, you know, ready and that and available to lend a helping hand.
Yes. Yes, totally.
You know, I understand from the launch of the pilot program that these mosques are to be transit centres. So what is the difference between that and a shelter? And does that mean that, you know, whoever that reaches out to transit centres would then need, you know, follow up to a proper shelter perhaps?
Yes. So that's a really good question, because a transit centre is that interim space, mm-hmm. right? If they're running a transit center, it's about that giving that immediate crisis response, to giving that immediate safe space, and also facilitating that assessment of what's needed next, what happens next, how do I connect the dots in order for this woman to have access to healing and resilience, and also being free from violence. When I hear transit center, for me, it's about that emergency. It's about crisis response. It's about urgency, and it's about building that fundamental base for the care and support to continue into the future. And that means the transit center within the mosque really needs to reach out and to build those critical links that are needed with, you know, state authorities, justice authorities, police authorities, health authorities, and then also very important to have that linkage with post-transit shelter. Mm-hmm. Not that, you know, necessarily the woman needs to then, you know, transition into another shelter, mm-hmm. but potentially transition into accommodation that she has control over, and which is safe for her and supportive of her healing. So, you know, potentially linkages to PPRs, local housing authorities, etc. So there's a lot of work to be done. It's not just about, you know, the first step, which is the commitment, is there, but there's a lot of learning that needs to take place, and a lot of more work that needs to be done.
Mm. It's about addressing that immediate need for a safe space in that moment, right? And then from there, the officers have to decide what's the next best step for the woman, for her children, if she has any, you know. But speaking of that transition then, if the woman needs a shelter, do we have enough shelters in Malaysia or even in the Klang Valley, really? I understand that, you know, I came across a study that WAO did, I think, at the end of 2019, which said that there was a lack of shelters even in Selangor and KL itself, right? I mean, is that still the case now?
Yes, so Malaysia actually has insufficient shelter facilities for women survivors of violence. So the baseline study that we did in 2019 really very clearly put that across and also assessed that those shelter spaces that are available are actually not set up to specifically deal with the needs of domestic violence survivors and their kids. So on the one hand, we know that it's prevalent. Right? One in every 10 ever partnered women in Peninsula Malaysia has been in a situation of domestic violence. And we have the law, the Domestic Violence Act. It's right now, this is what I always say, it's as good as it gets right now. It can be improved, but it's as good as it gets right now. There's a gap. So the law is there, but the ability to put the law into effective operation and ensure that women have access to that safe space so that they can go on and have access to justice is where that huge gap is. Not enough shelter spaces, for sure.
Mm. And, you know, for the shelters that are existing, right, how accessible are they to survivors of domestic violence or any forms of gender-based violence? You know, what are the main barriers towards accessing these shelters?
Okay, so geographic barriers, absolutely. So a woman who is in Jitra in Kedah may need a shelter as support, but, you know, the only shelter that she knows of is WAO and you know, we're not in Jitra, Kedah. So geography is a barrier. Ensuring that law enforcement, police, have that good working relationship with JKM is also very important because her immediate access, regardless of where she is in Malaysia, her identification as a domestic violence survivor and then linking her to the support that she needs, including shelter, takes place at that stage. So it's either the health provider that needs to be linked to JKM, the police needs to be linked to JKM, and JKM really is the linchpin. And they should be the agency that connects the woman to the service that she needs.
You know, if there aren't enough shelters in Malaysia, right, and you mentioned earlier that, you know, when people call the WAO hotline or if you get referrals, then you make that assessment of whether to take in that that person. What if, you know, in the case of WAO, right, what if you are over capacity? What's the next step after that?
We are always over capacity. So sometimes what happens is we need to put women on a waiting list. The other thing that we do is we then reach out to everyone and anyone that we know, you know, like, for instance, obviously with JKM, but also other shelters that we know of, and try to engage with them to see if that safe space is indeed available. The other thing that we always do with women as an alternative is to encourage them to think about family or friends that they can go to in lieu of. And, you know, that sometimes is not necessarily the best solution because frequently the perpetrator of the violence also knows the close connections of the survivor and the harassment will continue, you know, even into that new location that she has gone to. So it sounds really like intractable and, you know, we can be snowed down by the sheer scale of the work that needs to be done. But, you know, we need to bring ourselves to focus on what we can do in the situation that we are at or in. And also, you know, what we need to do to improve fundamentally the structures and like, you know, this new initiative with the mosques, with the 14 mosques, it's just wonderful. Mm. We are so happy.
So what will it take then for us to have more shelters?
Yes, we need a commitment from government. Recently, in budget 2021, there was an allocation made for domestic violence shelters.
Mm, 21 million.
Yes, exactly. So that's a great start. And we actually have been providing input and advice to KPWKM in their initiative to spend that money to set up the shelters. So that's an ongoing effort. Also, WAO works with state governments because, you know, it really needs to be localized, right? So it's great that KPWKM and also, you know, the Treasury, Ministry of Finance, they recognize that this is a need and they're putting money into it. But as well, the initiatives need to be localized. So it needs to be as well on the ground at the grassroots level. And this is where state governments become very important because we need to drill down to individual daerahs. You know, the eventual goal is that each daerah in Malaysia will have that shelter facility for women survivors of violence, specifically domestic violence.
Mm. It's always a multiple stakeholder situation, isn't it? Engaging the federal government, the state government, grassroots organizations. It's, you know, with so many things when it comes to supporting survivors of domestic violence, people can't work in silos.
Yes, exactly. It's all about joining the dots and connecting the dots. And, you know, the lovely thing about building these kinds of networks is that that network becomes potentially so important for other issues as well, like, mm-hmm. for instance, violence against children. You know, when you have that structure in place that responds to a societal harm that's so endemic, like domestic violence, that structure also becomes relevant for other forms of violence, you know? So things are moving, right? Things are moving. Structures are slowly being put in place. And, you know, WAO, we really like to think that we are the catalyst for this change because we don't just have subject matter expertise because we provide the service. We also collect a lot of data and we put out a lot of research. And that research is the evidence that drives our advocacy with all these stakeholders. So we have stakeholders coming together. We're moving. We're not moving fast enough. You know, things like COVID pandemic obviously is no assistance to this. We're getting there. It sounds like, you know, overwhelming, but you know what? We just take it apart, break it down step by step, and I'm confident that we'll get there by 2030. We will have a safe space for women in every district in Malaysia by 2030. Fingers crossed.
Mm. There's so many gaps that still need to be filled, right? You mentioned funding, you mentioned data, you mentioned, you know, and it's the human resource as well, isn't it? There's never enough of anything when it comes to supporting survivors.
Exactly. And, you know, I also want to maybe say a little bit here about and supporting the people who support survivors. So, like, for instance, this is not such a great climate for NGOs because we rely a lot on public funding, on corporate funding, etc. So in an economic environment like we are in right now, the nonprofits are also facing a crunch because the inflow of funds is much restricted. So also maybe I can just put out a little call out there to, you know, any corporates who are listening in, individuals who are listening in, we would really appreciate the support so that we can continue to do this life-saving work for women.
Hmm. And how much of a difference does having a shelter and all that necessary support, right, from psychosocial support, from childcare, from legal aid, like you mentioned, how much of that helps the survivor? You know, what difference does it make for them at the individual level?
At the individual level, you see the bloom, right? The woman, from the moment she comes into the WAO refuge, you know what? The first thing that a woman does when she steps into our refuge, she sleeps. She just sleeps. And so, you know, when she wakes up, it's usually like, this is the first time I've been able to sleep peacefully. Mm. So we just let her rest. So from that moment to the time where, you know, she's full shelter, she's in our economic resilience programs, etc., you see the bloom. And she's become the best version of herself that she can possibly be. So just looking at that woman's face, remembering what she looked like when she first came to us and what she looks like now and what she's achieving now, that is, you know, for me, the greatest endorsement that we're on the right path.
So, you know, emergency, this program, right, if you know, the transit centres are successful, like you say, I think it would be wonderful to see it expanded to, you know, more parts of the country to involve, you know, various other organisations. I mean, what other spaces you think can be sort of utilised in a program such as this, where you have areas in the community that are used also as transit centres?
Yeah, so our shelter standards actually enumerates all of those various examples. So it can range from hotels as emergency transit. It can be, you know, local PPRs, setting aside, you know, a couple of apartments as a transit center. There are so many different models. And I think times like this really require us to be super creative. I've been reading about a model in somewhere in the US, and I believe it might be California, where Airbnb, unused Airbnb spaces, are being leveraged on by local domestic violence shelters for safe spaces, transit centers. And the state pays the Airbnb provider for it. So there are a lot of different models out there. It can be something as simple as, you know, within a taman, you know, knowing that there is that one house there which is rented by the local authority and used as a safe space. Something that we've been talking to with the Selangor government is potentially also using these empty government houses. Sometimes you drive along University Road and you see all of these empty government houses just sitting there. We could use them, you know, turn control of those houses over to us. We can rehab it and we can use it as transit centers. So it's not that there is no space. There are spaces available. We just need to be smarter, more focused, and really creative with our thinking. How can we best leverage these spaces?
And that commitment, isn't it, to wanting to put in place these policy, these changes to make a more supportive environment for NGOs like WAO to help survivors.
Yes, absolutely. We need to see the commitments.
So let's talk about this recent MCO, right? Just yesterday, the Prime Minister announced that the entire country is now under a third nationwide MCO. What are WAO's concerns over the impact that this could have on domestic violence and other forms of gender-based violence? Because we've spoken about this again and again, you know, we touched on this during the first MCO and then during the second MCO, and now we are in a third cycle of this all over again. What are your concerns?
Yeah, so the concerns are multifold. So number one is we know that families, a lot of pressure is being placed on families, not necessarily just because of economic concerns, but, you know, being really close together. So relationships between parents and their kids are deteriorating. Relationships between partners are deteriorating. And also that women bear a lot of the burden in the family, right? They bear the burden of the kids' online education. They bear the burden of their own work. They bear the burden of, you know, providing care and support for the family. So that already is a huge concern. But additionally, yes, there is data shows that in times of these lockdowns, domestic violence increases, and it is so dangerous because the ability and possibility to exit that abusive situation is very much restricted. So we have a lot of concern. We're going to do, we are always doing a lot of blitzes on social media for public awareness, just to remind everyone, if you know of a domestic violence survivor, if you yourself are a domestic violence survivor, call WAO's hotline. We are available 24 hours. There is huge, huge concern. It's the silent pandemic, right? It's a pandemic within the pandemic. And I feel that we have increasingly more recognition amongst policymakers that domestic violence is, and violence against children is, an increased risk during times of lockdown. But we need to see that coming out publicly, you know, from government, from ministers' mouths, from the prime minister's mouth, that, you know, if you are a survivor of domestic violence, if you know of a survivor of domestic violence right now, please connect her to the services that she needs and provide that support. So very, very concerned.
Mm. So in this climate, right, what sort of policies or measures would you like to see to better support survivors of domestic violence?
Yeah. So we would very much like to see, whenever there is that announcement of MCO, mm-hmm. we would very much like to see as well, you know, in that initial public statement, that focus on, you know, the family. So, and also recognizing that if there's an increase and stating in situations of domestic violence, in situations of violence against children, violence against women, please ensure that you provide the support that's needed to connect them to the services that they need. These are the numbers that you can call, you know, so Talian Kase and etc. So we need to see that. We need to see also all of those public messaging that's coming out of MKN. Maybe one out of every three messages should address these kinds of problems, mm-hmm. these kinds of issues. And then also we'd like to see very clear, you know, filtering down. So we know that the police indeed are responsive and are, their SOPs actually, as they stand right now, seem to be, you know, responsive enough to situations like that. But we need to have also that guarantee that if there's a roadblock, you know, the personnel at the roadblock are also aware. If there's a woman who wants to lintas daerah and she says that I'm in this situation, you know, I'm going to a safe space, this is the police report that I had already made on the situation that I'm in, let her go. You know, so we've had situations before where, you know, two situations. So, for instance, one time when we called a Grab driver to pick up a woman to our shelter, mm-hmm. and, you know, he, against the odds, he, like, you know, pushed through the roadblock and advocated for this woman and got her to our shelter. But on the other hand, we've also had, you know, situations where a woman with three kids is calling the Grab to take, bring her to a safe space, and the Grab driver says, oh my God, there's too many people. I can't take you. I'm sorry. Here's my police report. No, but I can't do it, you know, because regulations state otherwise.
Mm.
So we need to have service provider also being mindful about this and responding to this. So yeah, we need more awareness. Mm.
And I guess the hope is that, you know, with transit centres like the mosques, right, this pilot program, having transit centres in the community should make that process easier, isn't it?
Yes, because, you know, for Muslims within that community, the mosque really is very much the centre of that sort of cultural life, religious life, social life, etc. And it is an anchor. So to have that safe space in that area, which is the anchor for that community, is potentially so impactful.
Mm. And, you know, before we wrap up, Sumitra, would you have a final message about this pilot program that we've been talking about also, right? And the need and the importance of shelters, you know, would you have a final message for listeners out there?
Yes. So if you are a survivor of domestic violence, if you know someone who is a survivor of domestic violence, reach out. Reach out for support. You can call the WAO hotline. The number is 03-3000-8858 and it's available 24 hours.
Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Sumitra.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
I've been speaking to Sumitra Viswanathan, the Executive Director of the Women's Aid Organisation, and we've been discussing the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development's recently launched pilot programme together with the Federal Territory's Islamic Religious Department, which will see 14 mosques across the capital city being used as transit centres for survivors of domestic violence. And Sumitra also shared, you know, what it takes to run a shelter from their perspective, from their experience at WAO. So if you missed any part of today's interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can look up the podcasts on bfm.my or on the BFM app. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.